Welcome to the Data Democracy. Presented by renowned O'Reilly author Olsen Benyu. Empowered by Xenia. Make your data accessible and discoverable by anyone, anywhere, at any time.
Hi everybody, I'm Ole Olesen Benyu, Chief Evangelist in Xenia and the author of the Enterprise Data Catalog published by Rally. On the Data Democracy, I have conversations about new trends in data and AI with pioneering data practitioners and data leaders. Today's guest is John Cook. John is the CTO and founder of Dataception, which has as its mission to accelerate time to decision making by getting insights produced from data products directly in the hands of the business with as little friction and as soon as possible. I have followed John for a while. I met him in person in Copenhagen at a Data Mesh kickoff event, and I thought he had some really interesting takes on Data Mesh and the terminology around Data Mesh that I wanted to explore further. Here are the three takeaways from my conversation with John. The first takeaway, Jamagda Magani is very clear in her book Data Mesh that she did not invent Data Mesh. More, she gave it a language, terms to understand it with. It's been very interesting for me to follow John because he has been doing data mesh architectures and styles since 2014, and he dives into that in the conversation with all the takeaways that he has gotten from this entire decade of doing data mesh architectures. Second, a positive legacy. That is a concept John Cook pitched for me, at least for the first time, and it refers to the fact that IT legacy, tech legacy can also be positive. We think way too little of this, and I think it's a great concept to keep in mind when we discuss new IT architectures. And third, to John, the composable enterprise is a concept that he finds very central to describe microservice architectures and data mesh architectures, and really think about the value that is produced by decentralized architectures altogether. Okay, enough of me talking. Let's hear what John has to say. Hi, John.
Hi, Ole. How are you doing?
Fine, and thank you for coming on.
No problem at all. Thank you for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure to come on.
Great, great, great. I'm happy to have you. So for our listeners, would you care to share some details of where you're based and what you do, what your background is and so forth?
Sure, sure. So yeah, so I'm based in East London, and I obviously run Dataception, founded that in 2019, but my background is been in the industry since literally 30 years in September. So I left university at 94, went into aerospace, started doing virtual reality in there, believe it or not, doing like plug me into all sorts of interesting machines to control my brainwaves and, you know, to control sort of fighter pilot cockpits and stuff like that. That's when I left uni. I was going to do become a PhD in virtual reality, believe it or not, back then. And the tech was quite different, as you can imagine, you know, very heavy helmets and stuff. So, that was fascinating. I was there for a little while and then went into computer gaming. So that was my next worked for a games company. And then kind of went into enterprise software in the late 90s. And started sort of looking at messaging, so started doing pub-sub messaging, low latency messaging, message brokers and all that kind of stuff, object brokers as well, did a bit of Corba, interestingly enough. In the early 2000s, went into service-oriented architecture, so did a lot of projects. I was actually doing a lot of contracting, so I was doing a lot of projects doing building the services, before microservices, and ended up working for a company who was doing low latency web services, ESBs and all that type of stuff, which was kind of interesting. And then So I went through the whole service or an architecture piece and left there and went into banking consultancy. So I started doing a lot of things like risk and finance, front office, low latency messaging, you know, market data, all that sort of stuff. Went through the whole Hadoop phase in the sort of mid-2000s. So actually managed to get a few of them to work, believe it or not, you know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Also, interesting enough, we'll talk a little bit more about it. I did my first kind of data mesh type implementation in 2014, which was really, really interesting. Domain tables, spinning up little metric engines, all that type of stuff, metric trees, which a lot of people are talking about now, semantic layers and all that sort of stuff. I was working for consultancy, ended up running a data and AI practice, started doing much more sort of analytics and started touching on AI. left there in 2000, and I always forget the dates, 2016 to PwC, and built up a data and AI practice. I started doing my first generative AI projects back then, 2017, believe it or not, on much more simplistic models than GPT now. But also did a lot around data strategy, data governance, and a lot of my sort of operating model stuff there as well, which was super interesting. Left there in 2018, joined Databricks when they were very young, you know, so or very small, so 230 people when I joined, I think. So I was there for a year, and then left, and then founded Dataception because I saw an interesting gap in the market, or gap in kind of the solution space. With what I ended up doing was basically talking to the business and translating between business analytics and technology and the data team. I spent a lot of time doing that at PwC, and even tried doing it at Databricks. And I thought, actually, there's a missing piece here fundamentally, and this whole composable architecture was the lessons I've learned. And then obviously the data mesh came out, so I started following the data mesh, started getting involved in data products, and that's really kind of what Dataception's here to do, is trying to get those business facing what we call data products, you know, which we'll talk about a bit later, mm-hmm. into the hands of the business, and be this iterative kind of agile UX type approach to actually analytics to actually deliver those in business. And that's kind of what we do. That's kind of our core USP. So yeah, that's a little potted history.
Super interesting, and there's so many things to dive into. And I do have prepared some questions for you. And as the listeners already know from the introduction, I was quite interested in your track record when I saw you presenting back in January here in Copenhagen, where I live. And you can definitely tell that you are a doer. And I mean that in a positive sense, that you have done this for quite a number of years. And you are very at ease in discussing the various architectures and technologies that I guess we could call decentralized data architectures represent, or data mindset, decentralized data mindsets altogether, right? Now, before we dive into the questions at hand, I have to say, given your presentation of your career here, I gotta ask, how did you make those Hadoop clusters work?
That's a really good question. So the one that my sort of poster child one is was working for a large bank, and we were in the treasury and finance department, and I actually built an architecture and built an operating model, and the operating model actually was the key bit of it. It wasn't actually the tech was hard. I mean, we all know Hadoop was very hard to do, and it was kind of just before Spark had really kind of gotten to into its kind of production kind of usage as we saw today. But it's the operating model, and we actually built something called the Data Factory, which was actually how we scope the analytics and then how we define those from an architecture perspective onto the platform. You know, so we had like, you know, four or five different types of analytics components that were built, and I defined that very clearly, got everyone to buy into them. We did some prototyping and then built kind of the process around that and got everyone to buy into that piece. And we said, this is what the limits of it are, this is kind of what the SLAs around each of those pieces, and this is kind of how we're going to do it. And this is kind of, you know, if you want to do something else, we need to, that's an exception case. And so we got very clear around the scope of what we were trying to deliver, very clear around the business value, and very clear around the architectural limits of Hadoop, because we all know MapReduce had lots of limits to it. We ended up also building some extra bits on top, funnily enough, to actually trying to cope with it. I mean, the security was a bit tricky. This particular bank ended up with 15 different Hadoop clusters because the security was so difficult, you know.
Yeah.
You know, all that kind of stuff, right? And the MapReduce engine had its limits and stuff. So we were very clear around, you know, what it's good at and what it wasn't good at. And I spent a lot of time defining that and proving it out and stuff. So there was a lot of engineering sat on top of it. And we built a whole kind of, you know, operational model and team to be able to do that. You know, including things like, you know, sandbox environments to try stuff out. And, you know, so it was very much a let's, you know, sort of suck it and see as you go, but let's be very clear around what we're trying to do and kind of what the limits are around that. So yeah, it worked, but it was pretty painful, as you can imagine. Quite a long process and a lot of pieces need to come together. So
yeah, totally. But I feel like when I talk to people that actually made that work, and I wasn't involved in any of that at the time, I was teaching at university, but it's just like it's such a feeling of the holy grail when people talk about those Hadoop clusters that actually worked, right? It's such a compelling architecture. And even today, I think it's something that a lot of people like think back of and say, okay, when that worked, that was just really, really cool because
yeah,
obviously there was some limits to the computational power of it, the scalability of it that you can't find today. But there was something like just very magical in the sense that in terms of control and use cases. And anyway, I guess that's a bit of tech nostalgia, but it is really interesting to hear people. I mean, we have so many constraints from other dimensions today, but I guess we will get back to that. Not necessarily.
Legacy's still here, right? I mean, we still have the positive legacy of, you know, I mean, the big problem with Hadoop was everyone tried to build a data warehouse on top of it, and it just wasn't designed for data warehousing. Now, but that was the main use case people tried to use it for, because of the join and joining data on MapReduce was a horror show. But you know, that was one of the main reasons it failed. But yeah, I didn't take that approach. We're not building a data warehouse. I had to design a whole new architecture to be able to support what we wanted to do, and that was a key learning for me. And that's actually echoes and the solution and the kind of reference architectures I do today. Mm-hmm. That was one of my first big epiphanies around this sort of space.
Oh great! And I think that's a perfect transition, actually, to the questions I prepared for you, because obviously, in a data mesh, what you don't want to put on top of that is one enterprise-wide data warehouse. You do not want like that to be the one and single use case for a data mesh, right? But
yeah.
I guess actually, in her book, Shemak Dagani is very open about the fact that she did not invent data mesh. Data mesh was a style, a way of thinking, architectures, technology components that came before her. And what she did, I guess, is to give us all a language to think about it, and always also, of course, push the field forward. I would be curious to know, John, what you think of data mesh, and if there is one single way to build a data mesh.
We probably spend the whole afternoon talking about that one topic.
For
me, that this concept of having composable units of work, you know, valuable work, federated out for different use cases, built by the teams who understand it, I'm all in. I'm absolutely on. This is kind of the sort of the, if you look at the kind of the take a step back, the core of the data mesh is obviously Zamat looked at, you know, the data warehouses and data lakes, and you know, originally it was an architectural thesis that, and so these teams building these kind of isolated ETL pipelines, and then that's not the way. And I actually agree with that. I actually totally agree with that. And the idea is that, you know, people understand the data, build their parts of it. Absolutely, I think that's absolutely right. I think what the challenge has been is how do we do it? You know, the translation from the vision, and it's really a vision thing. It's not, it's, you know, data mesh isn't a, you know, I'm going to go and build a data mesh. It's like I'm going to build my data infrastructure and use data mesh vision and data mesh principles and the concepts, which are all good, right? I mean, and the observations are absolutely spot on. I think the challenge has been is that transition from that vision principle type to that's how we do it, and there are some big challenges, right? The cross-domain join being one of them. You know, there's a load of kind of really gnarly data management implementation details that I've actually implemented and done, and know how difficult they are. You know, you can sort of sum up the kind of the architectural kind of thesis as data microservices. You know, it's kind of where it's coming from. It's all based on microservices and that kind of stuff. But that's data microservices are hard, and I've built many service-oriented architectures and the data microservices always end up being, oh, well, you need to join the data. It's like, oh, I need to join across the APIs, and I need to, you know, it gets really tricky, you know, because you want to join data, and this is kind of where GraphQL has come in to try and solve that problem and stuff. So I think there are some challenges translating from the top bit, from the the architectural kind of thesis down to the implementation. I think that's what a lot of people have done. But the actual vision and the outcome, I think, is definitely absolutely all in. I have a slightly different view around kind of the value bit, because I think the mesh was very much trying to target teams sharing data. That seems to be where it's kind of its sweet spot is. You know, there's, you get domain team A, business team A saying, I want this data from team B. Here's how you do it. Here's how you share that. And the data products that the mesh defines is, and we'll get into that in a minute, is how I package that, how I send that to you, how I access it, and all that kind of stuff. I think that's super useful, but those are just building blocks in the whole thing. For me, the value in something I talk about a lot is the end-to-end packaging of a use case, you know, a product, a business-facing piece, and the data is a massive part of that, but it's only one part of that, you know. So if it's the model, it's the UX, it's the API, it's the whole thing that actually delivers the business value. And I think if you take the data mesh kind of concept and go up the value chain around that, and not just composing the data sets, but you compose them all together with that piece, and you know, that to me is really where the true value is in my mind. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So it makes total sense. It's just like I want to ask a million questions at the same time, and I can't, obviously. But I was wondering, as you were talking, if there is even an alternative to these architectures. Let's agree we call them data mesh architectures, right? But there are like a bazillion different ways to do those architectures, right? Is there even an alternative? If you want to work with a data infrastructure, would you consider Hadoop an alternative to that? Or, I mean, I'm just like...
Sure. Sure. So I think one thing you say, so Hadoop was a technology that didn't, and that was one of the big problems with it. It didn't dictate the architecture. It's basically, here's a bunch of technologies, and it was built, 20 years ago with a particular scale in mind. You know, I think it was Google, wasn't it? Then they were trying to do stuff on DB2, and they couldn't scale it out. So they threw away 90% of what a database does and said, we're going to build this particular, it was the Dremel paper and all that sort of stuff, to hit this one particular use case, because we have this, these massive, like small amounts of data, small amounts of rows effectively on, a massive scale. So I think, Hadoop, and I've built many architectures on top of Hadoop, and that's kind of one of the key learnings, is that you've got to go, the level you've got to go from the from the technology upwards is a lot, So I think there are alternative architectures, but the one I see, the one I've been sort of talking about and actually seen work, is again, is this composability, this kind of, we call it the composable enterprise, where you have, and it comes from services and microservices, where you have a business process where you compartmentalize the different functional units of that business, those steps. There's different pieces, and you publish them separately, and then you wire them together through orchestration, through a nice graph and this kind of stuff, which is where services and microservices were supposed to get to. It's quite rare companies actually do it at that level. But that to me is really where the value is. And that's not just an architecture, that's actually an operating model.
Exactly.
You go to a business and say, here's my business process from A to Z. There's the bits in between it. Let's have different pieces servicing those parts of those, and some of them are analytical use cases, like a pricing engine or a recommendation engine or something like that. Some more I call transactional use cases, or like, I want to do a payment, I want to execute a trade, I want to do something, something much more on the transactional side. But it's an ecosystem of of components which all interact along the business process for me. And again, one of the things I try and steer away from this kind of analytical operational kind of, they're all parts of the business process. They just have different workloads. One's transactional, one's analytical, but they're all running the business, fundamentally. And that to me is really where we need to get to. We can discuss around architectures around that, but for me, that's the real value.
Yeah, agreed. And I think the more you steer away from theory and get toward like getting your hands dirty and actually building stuff, I think it becomes very, very difficult to make that distinction of operational and analytical data. So I agree in that a lot. I dare even say it keeps me up at night sometimes. But anyway, yes, there's so many things I want to ask, but I need to also ask the questions I prepared. So I think this is a nice segue to the next question I prepared. The fact that this distinction between operational and analytical data is actually difficult to uphold in real life. So I've been noticing on LinkedIn, and also when we chatted in person back in January and in your presentation, that you have correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you have some strong views on the terminology of data mesh. And one of them is about data products. Now, John, can you tell me, why do you think that data product is such a bad name for data products?
So I think what's good to lay out is kind of where I come from. So my role typically, well, the things I get involved in is literally, as I said, sitting between the business, data, and tech. I mean, people say this, but I do this a lot. I will sit with a CEO or a CFO or a line of business and work out a requirement of what they actually want. They want to deliver, and I'll understand their business. I might even do some business process engineering, some business process mapping, some analytical mapping, that type of stuff. And then I take that and go to, then we need to build it out. Guys go to the tech or data teams as well. For me, the language is trying to bridge those gaps between those worlds, the business world, the analytical world, the data world, the technical world stuff. And I spend all my time doing that. For me, it's not about, the mesh has got bad terminology and all that. It's about making my life easier. And I work a lot with products as well, product people as well. So I've been part of like end-to-end launches of products, customer facing, going through product market fit, all this type of stuff. And I really buy into that kind of methodology around product management stuff. It's not applicable for everything, but there's some bits of it which are fantastic. So that's where I come from. So what I don't want to be able to do, what I have to do is basically use one term for the business team and use the same term that means something completely different for the data and tech teams. That's fundamental. That's where I'm coming from. So the language barrier is difficult enough between data and tech and business. We all know this, right? So for me, it's trying to smooth that, lower the friction. So we'll go in and say, and if we use the product term, and this is something, and I'm talking to a product or a business person, they've got a very different thing and idea in their head around if I use it to a data person. If they use the kind of the meshes and implement a version of that. So I'm trying to disambiguate and trying to disintermediate between those things and saying, actually, if we're going to call something product and we're using product management, let's use that term in a way that product management understands. Because, and that's basically where I'm coming from. It's so if I want to deliver a product to a business person, they find useful, it solves their problem, the business problem, we're using the product life cycle. If it's a customer facing one, people are paying for it, that type of stuff. If I go to a business person saying, well, I'm going to use a data product, but it's basically a data set. They can look at me and go, are you monetizing the data? What are you doing? Is this a business line? Is this, there's lots of confusion. So for me, packaged data sets, which is basically what data mesh are talking about, with all the findability and that kind of stuff, are super important. And it's that control and that kind of design thinking is really important. But they're building blocks for a larger product. And if I'm doing end-to-end pieces, I need to use the terminology that everyone understands. I don't want to change the meaning of terms between teams, because that's just going to be a recipe for confusion, and it is, and I've tried it. It's a massive confusion. That's really where I come from. So I tend to use the term data container for the technical aspect of packaging, because it is a container of data. And that seems to resonate, and it's delivered by services. So if I've got a pricing service that's delivering pricing data, there might be four or five different pricing containers around that. The service gives that to the products, and the products themselves in our taxonomy are things like, I go to a business, say, you need a forecast to look at your sales, your sales funnel, or your historical metrics, and I use that kind of terminology. And the data that goes in it, the technical bit of it, is the container that gets delivered to that piece. And I've used that taxonomy a lot, and it really resonates and it really works very well, and there's no confusion and stuff like that. So yeah, quite a long-winded way of where I'm coming from, I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, totally, totally. I mean, that is some of the problems that is created, obviously, by gaining a language, right? That it's insisting on the certain meaning of words, and specifically for data products, I think it's like the ambition behind calling stuff a data product is very nice. I mean, the idea of making data something that is as consumable as a product, that of course is super nice, but in a business context, saying data product confuses line of business, because what they think of as products is, it can be services offered through software, no doubt about that, but it needs to be a specific product that clients of the companies are consuming, right? And that is not a data product, it never will be. So I totally get I think that's very clear, John. I still want to wrap some more salt in it, because I think I think you're onto something here with the terminology. So I think it would be very interesting for the listeners to dwell a little more on it. So what do you think of the term federated computational governance, which is a term from the data mesh book and circulating in theory and talks on data mesh?
Well, first of all, it's quite a mouthful, isn't it? It's quite hard to say. It's a lot of words, a lot of very technical words. But again, if we take a step back, I'm all with what it's trying to achieve. You know, fundamentally, let's get control. We talked about those composable components. Let's get the relevant control into those components all day long. You know, that's relevant data quality. You know, data quality is not a thing that's absolute, and it's not. It's down to what the use case is. In my mind, it's in eye of the beholder. You've got policies. You've got, you know, all that kind of control in there. Absolutely. Again, I'm not a huge fan of the term because it's quite hard to say and it's very technical and stuff. But if you talk about, you know, localized control and governance of those components, the language, it's a little less friction in terms of actually understanding what that is. So, but again, the concept I'm totally down with. You know, so we back in 2014, those little metric engines had their own data quality rules on them, had their own policies on them, because they were spanning different departments. We had domain tables that had, you know, that had different data quality rules, had different governance policies. Some had customer data, some didn't. So they had to have their own, you know, specific rules and control points and that kind of stuff, and their own governance around that. So yes, I think the concept is absolutely great in this kind of federated world, and absolutely likely and really needs to be there. But the terminology is a little bit too technical and a little bit too, let's say, too much of a mouthful in my mind. But yeah, the concept is great.
Yeah, but there is like elements in the data mesh theory and community in general that is sort of intellectualizing data just a tad too much for my taste. But again, it created a lot of momentum. So why don't I ask you a future question? Before I do that, John, I gotta say, listening once again, I think you had a very interesting career path, and so I want to provoke you just a little bit.
That's okay.
in the sense that so you started off in virtual reality, going to gaming. And that sounds super, super fun. And then you went into enterprise technologies working with data. And I gotta say, I would have made the different move. I would have made the opposite move right there, because you have so many, I don't know, I'm just kidding, right? I mean, there are many interesting problems in enterprise data, but gaming and virtual reality sounds super fun. So in that light, what are you most excited about for the future of data mesh? Where do you see like the most interesting use cases and scenarios for the future of data mesh? Or are you a data mesh skeptic? I mean, I don't think you are, but
absolutely. For me, I mean, as you know, Ole, I'm all about the use case. I'm all about the business value, delivering the use case for the business customer, whoever that's where I come from. That's my background. I think, you know, I get with the data mesh's vision, where it wants to get to, kind of this sort of stuff. I think there's some challenges, I say, with the implementation. I think, you know, there's, you know, the labeling, as we talked about. But actually, for me, it's about this composable, you know, component that delivers business value to a business person. That I'm all in, and there's quite a big overlap between what the data mesh is going and where I'm coming from. That, so that's all good. What's really interesting to me is, and I do a lot of work. We've done, you know, a lot of work around Gen AI and AI under the last probably 4 or 5 years. You know, done 4 or 5 actually Gen AI use cases. I mean, also classic AI as well. This changes things quite a bit in my mind, and this is the interesting thing. We're working on one at the moment, which is basically getting emails and basically working and turning them into risk models, effectively, you know, from customers. So basically, a small business gets emails in, and we have to try and work out what the risk profile is from the customers, what they've typed in the email, right? So that to me changes the whole kind of almost everything, like data management, concept of data quality, the concept of, you know, of how you, you know, how you deliver data to the different components, the pipelines, the whole thing, you know. And this is like our third or fourth use case doing this type of stuff. Did one 2 years ago, worked with a company, a really fantastic company, doing generating job adverts, you know, taking job adverts from recruiters and then creating, you know, diversity inclusion, SEO, that type of stuff using BERT models. Done another one around generating credit ratings, you know, generating the reports for that and stuff. So, and this to me is really where the, you know, it's not specifically data, not data mesh specific, but this is where we're going. And so, you know, most of sort of, even the data mesh itself and the a lot of the data governance, data management, it's all around structured data at the moment. Now we're into a world, the sort of floodgates are starting to open. It sort of, it trickled a little bit the last 4 or 5 or 6 years, you know, a few fringe use cases, but actually this has become more and more prevalent. So this to me is really fantastic, and it's super interesting. And you're into the, you've run the world, you're going for the world of rules to probabilistic, and you know that, and distribution curves and kind of, you know, and decoders and stuff like that, and actually delivering, you know, images. So, you know, obviously the thing we talked about with Novo Nordisk was, you know, delivering images with, like, you know, cancer classification. I just saw an interesting one yesterday around this, you know, those sorts of use cases. We're using images, you're using real life data, not structured data someone's interpreted and kind of modeled and what have you. That to me is the new frontier, and that to me is what gets me out of bed in the morning. You know, I've been in 30 years, I still love this industry, which is great. Those sorts of use cases. And like I said, what's happening is, you know, the things around data quality, around policies, around governance, around data models, even things like data contracts and stuff. Like, actually, how does that actually work, you know, in that kind of world? If we can construct information and knowledge out of raw data in a much more, you know, compressed format in terms of pipelines and stuff, that changes our whole kind of way of doing things, you know. And that to me is, well, obviously we're on the data section, we're on the forefront of that, which is fantastic, and that's really what excites me.
That sounds very cool. I mean, I guess you could label that unstructured data mesh, that, I mean, that opens so many perspectives in the sense of thinking of data mesh as something that, like, at its core works with structured data. How does a decentralized operating model look like for unstructured data? That is super interesting, and the use cases obviously are very, very different, but very exciting. That's a great perspective, and I think that is a very, very precise prediction of some of the very fun perspectives of future use cases. I totally agree in that. Okay, that was a great answer right there. Thank you, John.
No problem at all. I mean, one of the things I will say is one of the differences between what we think about, you know, data products and this kind of stuff and the data meshes, we actually build when we put the model together with the data as one composable delivery unit product, that kind of stuff. That also changes things quite a bit. You know, fundamentally, your there's less modeling involved, less kind of enterprise modeling and this kind of stuff. And I know this is obviously quite a contentious point, but it's once you start sort of picking attributes out of the of your data sets, and they could be like the raw data, like text data, as opposed to this, composing a kind of an ephemeral schema for that particular use case, and then delivering that gets really interesting, because then you can start doing some, get agility, you start getting, you know, you can have this kind of reconfiguring of your business process by building these kind of small components. There's obviously challenges around that, around versioning and kind of all that sort of stuff. But this is kind of where the microservice kind of was supposed to go, and it hasn't really gone there. But actually, in the analytics world with LLMs and Gen AI, you can start doing a lot more of this kind of stuff, because you shorten the pipelines. You're not doing this kind of, you know, these 4 or 5 steps before you actually access the data for business use cases and stuff. But that to me is really part of the game changing thing from my mind.
Yeah, agreed. Oh, this is very interesting. And unfortunately, time is up, John.
All right.
we can discuss further online and perhaps also in a future recording. But thank you very much for coming on the show, John. It was great. Take care.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me on. It was an absolute blast. So, yeah, really appreciate it. Thanks, Ole.
It was so fun.